Today is Monday, August 23rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, resistance mounts against Taliban rule.
I'm in my sanctuary. I'm in my stronghold, Panjshir Valley. The people of Panjshir Valley are very much united, and they want to defend, and they want to fight, and they want to resist against any totalitarian regime.
Plus, UN sounds alarm over poor health care in Afghanistan.
About one half of Afghanistan's population, including more than 4 million women and nearly 10 million children, need humanitarian assistance.
Also, tension between Israel and Palestine in the Gaza Strip. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Ahmad Massoud, leader of Afghanistan's last major outpost of anti-Taliban resistance, said on Sunday he hoped to hold peaceful talks with the Islamist movement that seized power in Kabul a week ago, but that his forces were ready to fight. Massoud, son of Ahmad Shah Massoud, one of the main leaders of Afghanistan's anti-Soviet resistance in the 1980s, said the forces did not just come from Panjshir, which also held out against the Taliban prior to 2001. He called for an inclusive, broad-based government in Kabul, representing all of Afghanistan's different ethnic groups, and said a, quote, totalitarian regime, unquote, should not be recognized by the international community.
I understand the circumstance, and unfortunately, it all came down to this after a very bad and sickening peace deal struck between Americans and the Taliban. And that was the foundation for the mess that we are at. And Mr. Khalilzad single-handedly created this mess, and he is responsible, and he should answer to humanity and to Afghans and to everyone. I am in my sanctuary. I am in my stronghold, Panjshir Valley. The people of Panjshir Valley are very much united, and they want to defend, and they want to fight, and they want to resist against any totalitarian regime, against any belief that wants to enforce their own belief and ideology upon the people. The people in here are just a small portion of the people of Afghanistan, and the geography of Panjshir is the smallest province in the whole Afghanistan. But what we are standing for right now, it's for the whole country. It's for sovereignty. It's for peace. For people, it's for inclusivity and tolerance and acceptance and moderation. It's for all these values. It's for our flag and banner and the belief that we have for this country. So what we are standing in here, it's just not just Panjshiris, but actually there are many other people from many other provinces who seek refuge inside Panjshir Valley, that they are standing tall with us, that they do not want to accept a different identity for Afghanistan than what we already believe. And we are not fighting a geography. We are not fighting one province. We are defending the whole country in one province. That's what's happening. And we want to make Taliban realize that the only way forward is through negotiation.
That's Ahmad Massoud, leader of Afghanistan's anti-Taliban resistance. The Taliban has set its sights on Panjshir Valley, where remnants of anti-Taliban resistance led by Ahmad Massoud have turned it into a stronghold. Reports indicate ongoing clashes with unspecified number of deaths on both sides. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
After announcing that amnesty for all their opponents, have been trying to persuade Ahmad Massoud to give up any resistance that he promised to put up. Then in the meantime, we saw a couple of days ago that this province of Panjshir, which is in the north, has another Afghan province on its border, which is called Baghlan. And in that province, Massoud's armed supporters evicted the Taliban from three districts. And that was quite a setback to the Taliban militarily at a time when they were celebrating their retaking control of Afghanistan. So that annoyed the Taliban, and then they came out with these statements that this was a betrayal of the amnesty that the Taliban had announced. So they then sent their commando forces, hundreds of new soldiers from surrounding provinces into Baghlan to fight back. And then they also, last night, very large number of Taliban fighters mounted an assault against Panjshir province itself from three sides. But Panjshir is located in such a rugged mountainous area that it is very difficult for ground forces to really make an attack and make any progress on the battlefield, because going up to the Panjshir Valley, there are roads that have been heavily mined by Massoud fighters. So it is not easy for Taliban fighters to really go and do something effective against these insurgent forces. So we have heard from both the sides, like Massoud people on social media have put out repeated statements in the last few hours that they have inflicted heavy casualties. As much as 300 Taliban fighters, they say, have been killed in the their attempt to assault the Panjshir area. But again, Taliban have come out and denied those claims as baseless, saying they have not suffered any casualties and that they have surrounded the Panjshir province from all areas and they are still making advances. It is very difficult to really determine exactly which side is telling you the truth. In Afghanistan, we know for sure that all the warring factions exaggerate their battlefield claims.
How much of a threat is Massoud and his group to the Taliban?
On one hand, we see the Taliban have been able to take control of most of the country. But on the other hand, we see it's the same Panjshir province that Massoud's father, who was assassinated in 2001, successfully defended this province while the Taliban were in control of most of Afghanistan during the 1990s. And Taliban were unable to really defeat Ahmad Shah Massoud, father of Ahmad Massoud. That's why late Ahmad Shah Massoud is considered as a hero of the Tajik Afghans, the minority Tajik Afghans, that he never surrendered to the Taliban, who are ethnic Pashtuns, back in the 1990s. And that legacy, Massoud's son is trying to carry forward by trying to defend it. Now, if this crisis and this conflict prolongs, this is going to encourage other provinces, people in other provinces who may not be happy with the arrival of the Taliban in their areas, especially in non-Pashtun areas. And they may also pick up arms and, you know, create these kind of resistance. And that will definitely create problem for the Taliban because they are really in need of establishing a secure Afghanistan to so that they can tell the world that it is time for the world to accept whatever administration they put in place, that it has brought peace to the country. So we may see if this conflict, this limited conflict for the control of Panjshir province prolongs, we may see group picking up arms in other parts of Afghanistan and creating serious security challenges for the Taliban.
That's VOA's Ayaz Goh speaking with me from Islamabad. Britain is urging the United States to extend its evacuation efforts in Kabul beyond the current August 31st deadline, saying without Americans, other countries will have no choice but to stop their own operations to help people fleeing the Taliban takeover. Prime Minister Boris Johnson plans to press President Joe Biden at an emergency meeting of Group of Seven leaders on Tuesday, convened by Britain. But Taliban negotiating team member Suhail Shaheen says the group would have to, quote, react, unquote, if the U.S. tried to extend the August 31 cutoff date.
There is no need for that. I think it will deteriorate the relation, that will create mistrust between us. If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
That's Taliban negotiating team member Suhail Shaheen. The World Health Organization is sounding the alarm about healthcare in Afghanistan, where conflict has left millions of people vulnerable to hunger and illnesses. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
About one half of Afghanistan's population, including more than 4 million women and nearly 10 million children, need humanitarian assistance. The World Health Organization says one third of the population is facing acute hunger, and more than half of all children under age 5 are malnourished. It says the current drought is expected to worsen an already dire situation. WHO officials say they are committed to staying in Afghanistan and delivering critical health care services. However, WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich notes that only will be possible if all parties in the war-torn country respect and protect civilians, health workers, and health facilities.
Continuity of health services must continue without interruption across the country, with a focus on ensuring women have access to female health workers. Most of major health facilities are functional, and this is based on a provincial level field monitoring. Health workers have been called to return to or to remain in their posts, including female health staff.
The new Taliban rulers of Afghanistan have promised to protect women's rights and allow them to work and study. However, since they have seized control of the country, there have been reports of female workers having been dismissed from their jobs. Nearly 300,000 Afghans have fled their homes in the last 2 months, fearing for their safety as U.S. and NATO forces hastened their departure from the country. Jazarevich says those newly displaced people are extremely vulnerable. They lack food, shelter, and many suffer from a variety of health problems.
In areas where people have recently fled, including Kabul, WHO received field reports of increase in cases in diarrhea, malnutrition, high blood pressure, COVID-19, black symptoms, and reproductive health. When it comes to trauma cases, close to 14,000 conflict-related trauma received at 70 WHO health facilities in July 21.
He says that is more than three times higher than the number of trauma cases received during the same period last year. The WHO spokesman says attacks on healthcare facilities also pose a major challenge. In the first half of this year, he notes 26 health facilities were damaged and 31 healthcare workers were assaulted. He adds 12 of the health workers were killed.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. The Biden administration is vowing to safely evacuate all Americans who want to leave Afghanistan, even as the situation at the Kabul airport grows more tense. Evacuations continued Sunday for Americans and Afghans who helped the U.S. military, and the U.S. has ordered commercial airlines to help. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Another day of rushed and chaotic attempts to evacuate Americans and their Afghan allies as soldiers help families board a military plane on the tarmac in Kabul. The Biden administration says it will do whatever it takes, including ordering commercial airlines to aid in evacuation from the region after evacuees leave Kabul. Meanwhile, in Washington, the president reaffirmed the country's commitment to Americans and their Afghan allies still in Afghanistan.
Any American who wants to get home will get home. We've also been evacuating the citizens of our NATO allies.
German soldiers overnight prepared to unload two helicopters at the airport in Kabul. Their mission is part of a growing international effort to evacuate the area around the Afghan capital. But Republican U.S. Senator and combat veteran Joni Ernst tells ABC's This Week the president was slow to engage America's partners.
This is where President Biden, unfortunately, has really, he has messed it up. I'll just put it out there. Of course, with our international community, with this haphazard withdrawal, if we had been working with those allies, those partner countries, this would have been a lot easier.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken told Fox News Sunday that with the recent events in Afghanistan, it is a powerful and an emotional time for our allies. By all accounts, the withdrawal has been anything but easy, with the U.S. military reporting an Afghan woman gave birth to a baby girl aboard an evacuation flight to Germany. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin says Biden had no good options, but did the best he could with intelligence assessments he was given.
The president listened to our input. Again, he conducted a very rigorous and thoughtful process, and he made a decision. And I support that decision.
Secretary Blinken told CBS Face the Nation on Sunday the administration had evacuated about 8,000 people in the previous 24 hours. The administration continues talks with Taliban leaders to secure safe passage out, but further complicating matters is the threat of an Islamic State group in Afghanistan itself focused on disrupting American activities on the ground. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Greece has erected a 25-mile fence and installed a new surveillance system on its border with Turkey as fears mount of a surge in Afghan refugees trying to reach Europe. Greece has faced reoccurring refugee crises since 2015, when more than 1 million, mainly Syrian refugees, swarmed through its land and sea borders to escape conflict in their homeland. Anthi Karasava has more from Athens.
Speaking from Checkpoint 1, Greece's key border post along the country's rugged land frontiers with Turkey, Public Order Minister Michailis Chrysochoidis sounded what he called a clear and fair warning. Our borders, he said, will remain safe and inviolable, and we will not allow any indiscriminate inflow of refugees. The minister's warning sounded as he toured the checkpoint and a soaring 25-mile steel fence completed in recent days amid fears of a deluge of Afghan refugees fleeing for their lives after the Taliban takeover. Defense Minister Nikos Panayotopoulos said the Greek fence along the shallow Evros River that separates the country from Turkey is just part of a bigger plan pieced together by authorities to further shield the country against a new migration crisis. We are on alert, but Greece, he said, will continue to protect itself from any threat. The defense minister said special surveillance systems, including a fleet of drones and night cameras, had been installed across the new fence to watch for illegal crossings. Army bulldozers were also seen plowing across stretches of the country's northern frontier with Bulgaria, where military trucks were unloading barbed wire to erect more fences. Greece has been on the front line of Europe's migration woes since refugees from Syria streamed through in 2015, sparking the biggest migration push in the European continent since the Second World War. Greece has repeatedly complained to the European Union about doing too little to support hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees trapped in the country for 6 years, as neighboring states and other European nations, including Germany, turned a blind eye, sealing their borders to keep them away. The United Nations is now making appeals for countries in the region to not do the same to fleeing Afghanis. But the government in Athens says it won't sit passively. In fact, in a surprise move, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis placed an urgent telephone call to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Friday, trying to drum up support and a common strategy on how to deal with a potential migration crisis in the region. Details of the meeting or any decision between the two men were not released. But no sooner had the call ended than Erdogan warned Europe he too would not allow Turkey to become what he called a refugee warehouse. Turkey's already hosting 3.6 million refugees from Syria and more than 300,000 Afghans. In Greece, meanwhile, humanitarian groups, Afghan refugees and leftist parties are now up in arms about the border fence and the government's controversial plan of deterrence. Those groups say the plan completely disregards human rights and the right to asylum to those fleeing danger and bloodshed. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, Song Kim, held a meeting with his South Korean counterpart, Noh Kyu-duk, on Monday as the two allies looked for ways to entice Pyongyang back to talks over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles program. Calling the U.S.-South Korean military exercises a long-standing routine, Kim urged for diplomacy with North Korea. He called the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea, quote, sacred, unquote. Kim's four-day visit comes as a brief thaw in inter-Korean relationships in July gave way to a new standoff over U.S.-South Korea military exercises that North Korea has warned could trigger a security crisis. The nine-day exercise began on August 16th, with silence so far from North Korea's state media, despite fears that the country could conduct a missile test or take other actions to underscore its disapproval.
And we'll continue to lend our support to inter-Korean humanitarian cooperation projects. The United States does not have hostile intent towards the DPRK. The ongoing U.S.-ROC combined military exercises are long-standing, routine, and purely defensive in nature, and support the security of both of our countries. I continue to stand ready to meet with my North Korean counterparts anywhere at any time. On the importance of the U.S.-ROC alliance, I cannot put it better than President Biden himself, who called the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea sacred.
That's the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, Song Kim. This is the Voice of America. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris vowed, quote, enduring engagement, unquote, in Asia on Monday. During a visit in Singapore, she offered assurances of Washington's commitment to the region, even as the United States completes its chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan following the Taliban takeover. The desperate scenes of thousands trying to flee Kabul have cast a shadow of the United States' status as a reliable ally. But in Singapore, a first step on a trip that also includes Vietnam, Harris repeatedly insisted that Washington could be depended on. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong welcomed her reassurances and said Singapore was offering a military aircraft to help the evacuation from Kabul Airport, overseen by the U.S. military. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America, I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Two Palestinians, one of them a 13-year-old boy and an Israeli soldier, were wounded in renewed fighting along the Gaza border. Hundreds of Palestinian protesters came to the Gaza border to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque more than 50 years ago. The new tensions come as Israel Prime Minister Naftali Bennett meets U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington later this week. Linda Grandstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
An Israeli army spokesman said protesters began gathering at the border fence on Saturday afternoon, and Palestinians threw explosives and rocks across the border at Israeli soldiers. The army said the soldiers responded with crowd dispersal means, including live fire. Palestinians released a video that showed them trying to grab the gun of an Israeli soldier who poked it through a hole in the fence the soldiers used as a sniper position. The video shows a Palestinian shooting a pistol through the same hole, hitting the Israeli soldier in the head. Israel responded with attacks on Hamas weapons stores in Gaza, but military analysts said the response was low-key. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Israel will not accept attacks on its soldiers. He said that Israel will settle the score with anyone who attacks its soldiers. It is the most tense the border between Israel and Gaza has been since May, when the two sides fought an 11-day war that left at least 260 Palestinians and 13 people in Israel dead. It also comes as Bennett is scheduled to hold his first meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden. While the Palestinian issue will be on the agenda, Israel is even more concerned about the possibility of Iran becoming a nuclear power. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Chris Hipkins, a government minister in New Zealand, admitted that the country's, quote, elimination, unquote, approach to achieve a, quote, COVID zero, unquote, status may no longer be viable as the Delta variant is proven difficult to control. The government in Wellington had extended a nationwide lockdown until at least Friday, and 107 infections have been detected so far. Stay-at-home orders in the city of Auckland, the center of the outbreak, are to remain until at least August 31st. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand has been imposing lockdowns at the first sign of an outbreak, implementing a strategy to crush COVID-19 and curb the spread of the virus. It also closed its borders to most foreign nationals in March 2020 and returning citizens are subject to strict quarantine controls. The country has tried to keep the pandemic at bay and earned the name Fortress New Zealand due to the strategy. However, the government is now admitting there are cracks in the country's approach in combating the pandemic. Health officials have linked the Delta variant outbreak to a traveller who returned from the Australian state of New South Wales on August 7. Chris Hipkins, the COVID-19 response minister, told a local TV station, TVNZ Sunday, that eliminating the virus would be a difficult task.
Delta does raise some big questions that we're going to have to grapple with. You know, less than 24 hours between someone getting it and then passing it on to others. That's like nothing we've dealt with in this pandemic so far. And that does change everything. It does mean that all of our existing protections start to look less adequate and less robust as a result of that. So we're looking very closely at what more we can do there. But yes, it does raise some pretty big questions about what the long-term future of our plans are.
Australia is also moving away from its long-held elimination strategy. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has warned that people would have to learn to live with the virus. But he said lockdowns would continue until at least 70% of the population was fully vaccinated. So far, just under a third of Australians have received two doses. A nighttime curfew in virus-hit parts of Sydney began Monday as Delta variant infections increase in Australia's biggest city. Masks are now mandatory for all residents outdoors. The police have been given greater powers to lock down apartment blocks and order people to isolate for 14 days if they break any restrictions. New South Wales and Victoria, Australia's most populous states, are in lockdown, along with the national capital, Canberra. New Zealand has recorded about 3,000 coronavirus cases and 26 deaths since the pandemic began. Australia has reported 44,000 infections and 981 deaths, according to the country's health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.